establishment, officially called the Segregation and Isolation Building, constitutes a prison inside a prison. Among the inmates, the lower floor is known as the hole, the place to which difficult prisoners, the hard rock troublemakers, are now and then banished. The upper story is reached by climbing a circular iron staircase. At the top is Death Row. The first time the Clutter murderers ascended the staircase was late one rainy April afternoon. Having arrived at Lansing after an 8-hour, 400-mile car ride from Garden City, the newcomers had been stripped, showered, given close haircuts, and supplied with coarse denim uniforms and soft slippers. In most American prisons, such slippers are a condemned man's customary footwear. Then armed escorts marched them through a wet twilight to the coffin-shaped edifice, hustled them up the spiral stairs and into 2 of the 12 side-by-side cells that comprise Lansing's death row. The cells are identical. They measure 7 by 10 feet and are unfurnished except for a cot, a toilet, a basin, and an overhead light bulb that is never extinguished night or day. The cell windows are very narrow, and not only barred but covered with a wire mesh black as a widow's veil. Thus, the faces of those sentenced to hang can be but hazily discerned by passers-by. The doomed themselves can see out well enough. What they see is an empty dirt lot that serves in summer as a baseball diamond, beyond the lot a piece of prison wall, and above that, a piece of sky. The wall is made of rough stone. Pigeons nest inside its crevices. A rusty iron door, set into the part of the wall visible to the row's occupants, rouses the pigeons whenever it is opened, puts them in a flap, for the hinges creak so, scream. The door leads into a cavernous storage room, where on even the warmest day the air is moist and chilly. A number of things are kept there. Stockpiles of metal used by the convicts to manufacture automobile license plates, lumber, old machinery, baseball paraphernalia, and also an unpainted wooden gallows that smells faintly of pine. For this is the state's execution chamber. When a man is brought here to be hanged, the prisoners say he has gone to the corner, or, alternatively, paid a visit to the warehouse. In accordance with the sentence of the court, Smith and Hickok were scheduled to visit the warehouse 6 weeks hence, at 1 minute after midnight on Friday, May 13th, 1960. Kansas abolished capital punishment in 1907. In 1935, due to a sudden prevalence in the Midwest of rampaging professional criminals, Alvin Old Creepy Carpus, Charles Pretty Boy Floyd, Clyde Barrow and his homicidal sweetheart Bonnie Parker, the state legislators voted to restore it. However, it was not until 1944 that an executioner had a chance to employ his craft. Over the next 10 years, he was given 9 additional opportunities. But for 6 years, or since 1954, there had been no paychecks for a hangman in Kansas, except at the Army and Air Force disciplinary barracks, which also has a gallows. The late George Docking, governor of Kansas from 1957 through 1960, was responsible for this hiatus, for he was unreservedly opposed to the death penalty. I just don't like killing people. Now, at that time, April 1960, there were in United States prisons 190 persons awaiting civil execution. 5, the Clutter killers included, were among the lodgers at Lansing. Occasionally, important visitors to the prison are invited to take what one high official calls a little peek at death row. Those who accept are assigned a guard who, as he leads the tourist along the iron walkway fronting the death cells, is likely to identify the condemned with what he must consider comic formality. "And this," he said to a visitor in 1960, "this is Mr. Perry Edward Smith. Now next door, that's Mr. Smith's buddy, Mr. Richard Eugene Hickok. And over here we have Mr. Earl Wilson. And after Mr. Wilson, meet Mr. Bobby Joe Spencer. And as for this last gentleman, I'm sure you recognize the famous Mr. Lowell Lee Andrews. Earl Wilson, a husky, hymn-singing Negro, had been sentenced to die for the kidnapping, rape, and torture of a young white woman. The victim, though she survived, was left severely disabled. Bobby Joe Spencer, white, an effeminate youth, had confessed to murdering an elderly Kansas City woman, the owner of a rooming house where he lived. Prior to leaving office in January 1961, Governor Docking, who had been defeated for re-election, in large measure because of his attitude toward capital punishment, commuted the sentences of both these men to life imprisonment, which generally meant that they could apply for parole in 7 years. However, Bobby Joe Spencer soon killed again. Stabbed with a shiv another young convict, his rival for the affections of an older inmate. As one prison officer said, "Just two punks fighting over a jocker." This deed earned Spencer a second life sentence. But the public was not much aware of either Wilson or Spencer. Compared to Smith and Hickok, or the fifth man on the row, Lowell Lee Andrews, the press had rather slighted them. 2 years earlier, Lowell Lee Andrews, an enormous, weak-eyed boy of 18 who wore horn-rimmed glasses and weighed almost 300 pounds, had been a sophomore at the University of Kansas, an honor student majoring in biology. Though he was a solitary creature, withdrawn and seldom communicative, his acquaintances, both at the university and in his hometown of Walcott, Kansas, regarded him as exceptionally gentle and sweet-natured. Later, one Kansas paper printed an article about him entitled, "The Nicest Boy in Walcott." But inside the quiet young scholar there existed a second, unsuspected personality. One with stunted emotions and a distorted mind through which cold thoughts flowed in cruel directions. His family, his parents and a slightly older sister, Jenny Marie, would have been astounded had they known the daydreams Lowell Lee dreamed throughout the summer and autumn of 1958. The brilliant son, the adored brother, was planning to poison them all. The elder Andrews was a prosperous farmer. He had not much money in the bank, but he owned land valued at approximately $200,000. A desire to inherit this estate was ostensibly the motivation behind Lowell Lee's plot to destroy his family. For the secret Lowell Lee, the one concealed inside the shy, church-going biology student, fancied himself an ice-hearted master criminal. He wanted to wear gangsterish silk shirts and drive scarlet sports cars. He wanted to be recognized as no mere bespectacled, bookish, overweight, virginal schoolboy. And while he did not dislike any member of his family, at least not consciously, murdering them seemed the swiftest, most sensible way of implementing the fantasies that possessed him. Arsenic was the weapon he decided upon. After poisoning the victims, he meant to tuck them in their beds and burn down the house, in the hope that investigators would believe the deaths accidental. However, one detail perturbed him. Suppose autopsies revealed the presence of arsenic, and suppose the purchase of the poison could be traced to him. Toward the end of summer, he evolved another plan. He spent 3 months polishing it. Finally, there came a near-zero November night when he was ready to act. It was Thanksgiving week, and Lowell Lee was home for the holidays, as was Jenny Marie, an intelligent but rather plain girl who attended a college in Oklahoma. On the evening of November 28th, somewhere around 7, Jenny Marie was sitting with her parents in the parlor watching television. Lowell Lee was locked in his bedroom reading the last chapter of The Brothers Karamazov. That task completed, he shaved, changed into his best suit, and proceeded to load both a semi-automatic .22-caliber rifle and a Ruger .22-caliber revolver. He fitted the revolver into a hip holster, shouldered the rifle, and ambled down a hall to the parlor, which was dark except for the flickering television screen. He switched on a light, aimed the rifle, pulled the trigger, and hit his sister between the eyes, killing her instantly. He shot his mother 3 times and his father 2. The mother, eyes gaping, arms outstretched, staggered toward him. She tried to speak, her mouth opened, closed, but Lowell Lee said, "Shut up." To be certain she obeyed him, he shot her 3 times more. Mr. Andrews, however, was still alive. Sobbing, whimpering, he thrashed along the floor toward the kitchen, but at the kitchen's threshold the son unholstered his revolver and discharged every chamber, then reloaded the weapon and emptied it again. Altogether, his father absorbed 17 bullets. Andrews, according to statements credited to him, didn't feel anything about it. The time came, and I was doing what I had to do. That's all there was to it. After the shootings, he raised a window in his bedroom and removed the screen, then roamed the house, rifling dresser drawers and scattering the contents. It was his intention to blame the crime on thieves. Later, driving his father's car, he traveled 40 miles over snow-slippery roads to Lawrence, the town where the University of Kansas is located. En route, he parked on a bridge, dismantled his lethal artillery, and disposed of it by dropping the parts into the Kansas River. But of course, the journey's true purpose was to arrange an alibi. First, he stopped at the campus house where he roomed. He talked with the landlady, told her that he had come to pick up his typewriter, and that because of the bad weather, the trip from Walcott to Lawrence had taken 2 hours. Departing, he visited a movie theater, where, uncharacteristically, he chatted with an usher and a candy vendor. At 11, when the movie let out, he returned to Walcott. The family's mongrel dog was waiting on the front porch. It was whining with hunger, so Lowell Lee, entering the house and stepping across his father's corpse, prepared a bowl of warm milk and mush. Then, while the dog was lapping it up, he telephoned the sheriff's office and said, "My name is Lowell Lee Andrews. I live at 6040 Walcott Drive, and I want to report a robbery." 4 officers of the Wyandotte County Sheriff's Patrol responded. One of the group, Patrolman Myers, described the scene as follows. "Well, it was 1 in the morning when we got there. All the lights in the house was on. And this big, dark-haired boy, Lowell Lee, he was sitting on the porch petting his dog, patting it on the head. Lieutenant Athey asked the boy what happened, and he pointed to the door, real casual, and said, 'Look in there.' Having looked, the astonished officers summoned the county coroner, a gentleman who was also impressed by young Andrew's callous nonchalance, for when the coroner asked him what funeral arrangements he wished to have made, Andrews replied with a shrug, 'I don't care what you do with them.' Shortly, 2 senior detectives appeared and began to question the family's lone survivor. Though convinced he was lying, the detectives listened respectfully to the tale of how he had driven to Lawrence to fetch a typewriter, gone to a movie, and arrived home after midnight to find the bedrooms ransacked and his family slain. He stayed with the story and might never have altered it if, subsequent to his arrest and removal to the county jail, the authorities had not obtained the aid of the Reverend Mr. Verto C. Dameron. The Reverend Dameron, a Dickensian personage, an unctuous and jolly brimstone and damnation orator, was minister of the Grandview Baptist Church in Kansas City, Kansas, the church the Andrews family attended regularly. Awakened by an urgent call from the county coroner, Dameron presented himself at the jail around 3 a.m., whereupon detectives, who had been strenuously but abortively interrogating the suspect, withdrew to another room, leaving the minister to consult privately with his parishioner. It proved a fatal interview for the latter, who many months afterward gave this account of it to a friend. "Mr. Dameron said, 'Now, Lee, I've known you all your life, since you were just a little tadpole. And I knew your daddy all his life. We grew up together. We were childhood friends. And that's why I'm here. Not just because I'm your minister, but because I feel like you're a member of my own family. And because you need a friend that you can talk to and trust. And I feel terrible about this terrible event. And I'm every bit as anxious as you are to see the guilty party caught and punished.' He wanted to know, was I thirsty? And I was. So he got me a Coke. And after that, he's going on about the Thanksgiving vacation and how do I like school, when all of a sudden he says, 'Now, Lee, there seems to be some doubt among the people here regarding your innocence. I'm sure you'd be willing to take a lie detector and convince these men of your innocence so they can get busy and catch the guilty party. Then he said, Lee, you didn't do this terrible thing, did you? If you did, now is the time to purge your soul. The next thing was, I thought, what difference does it make? And I told him the truth, most everything about it. He kept wagging his head and rolling his eyes and rubbing his hands together, and he said it was a terrible thing, and I would have to answer to the Almighty, have to purge my soul by telling the officers what I'd told him, and would I? Receiving an affirmative nod, the prisoner's spiritual advisor stepped into an adjacent room, which was crowded with expectant policemen, and elatedly issued an invitation. Come on in. The boy's ready to make a statement. The Andrews case became the basis for a legal and medical crusade. Prior to the trial, at which Andrews pleaded innocent by reason of insanity, the psychiatric staff of the Menninger Clinic conducted an exhaustive examination of the accused. This produced a diagnosis of schizophrenia, simple type. By simple, the diagnosticians meant that Andrews suffered no delusions, no false perceptions, no hallucinations, but the primary illness of separation of thinking from feeling. He understood the nature of his acts, and that they were prohibited, and that he was subject to punishment. But, to quote Dr. Joseph Satin, one of the examiners, Lowell Lee Andrews felt no emotions whatsoever. He considered himself the only important, only significant person in the world. And in his own seclusive world, it seemed to him just as right to kill his mother as to kill an animal or a fly. In the opinion of Dr. Satin and his colleagues, Andrews' crime amounted to such an undebatable example of diminished responsibility that the case offered an ideal chance to challenge the McNaughton Rule in Kansas courts. The McNaughton Rule, as has been previously stated, recognizes no form of insanity provided the defendant has the capacity to discriminate between right and wrong. Legally, not morally. Much to the distress of psychiatrists and liberal jurists, the rule prevails in the courts of the British Commonwealth and, in the United States, in the courts of all but half a dozen or so of the states and the District of Columbia, which abide by the more lenient, though to some minds impractical, Durham rule, which is simply that an accused is not criminally responsible if his unlawful act is the product of mental disease or mental defect. In short, what Andrews' defenders, a team composed of Menninger Clinic psychiatrists and two first-class attorneys, hoped to achieve was a victory of legal landmark stature. The great essential was to persuade the court to substitute the Durham rule for the McNaughton rule. If that happened, then Andrews, because of the abundant evidence concerning his schizophrenic condition, would certainly be sentenced not to the gallows or even to prison, but to confinement in the state hospital for the criminally insane. However, the defense reckoned without the defendant's religious counselor, the tireless Reverend Mr. Dameron, who appeared at the trial as the chief witness for the prosecution, and who, in the overwrought, rococo style of a tent show revivalist, told the court he had often warned his former Sunday school pupil of God's impending wrath. I says, there isn't anything in this world that is worth more than your soul, and you have acknowledged to me a number of times in our conversations that your faith is weak, that you have no faith in God. You know that all sin is against God, and God is your final judge, and you have got to answer to him. That is what I said to make him feel the terribleness of the thing he'd done, and that he had to answer to the Almighty for this crime. Apparently, the Reverend Dameron was determined young Andrews should answer not only to the Almighty, but also to more temporal powers, for it was his testimony, added to the defendant's confession, that settled matters. The presiding judge upheld the McNaughton rule, and the jury gave the state the death penalty it demanded. Friday, May 13th, the first date set for the execution of Smith and Hickok, passed harmlessly, the Kansas Supreme Court having granted them a stay pending the outcome of appeals for a new trial filed by their lawyers. At that time, the Andrews verdict was under review by the same court. Perry's cell adjoined Dick's. Though invisible to each other, they could easily converse. Yet Perry seldom spoke to Dick, and it wasn't because of any declared animosity between them. After the exchange of a few tepid reproaches, their relationship had turned into one of mutual toleration, the acceptance of uncongenial but helpless Siamese twins. It was because Perry, cautious as always, secretive, suspicious, disliked having the guards and other inmates overhear his private business, especially Andrews, or Andy as he was called on the row. Andrews' educated accent and the formal quality of his college-trained intelligence were anathema to Perry, who, though he had not gone beyond third grade, imagined himself more learned than most of his acquaintances, and enjoyed correcting them, especially their grammar and pronunciation. But here suddenly was someone, just a kid, constantly correcting him. Was it any wonder he never opened his mouth? Better to keep your mouth shut than to risk one of the college kids' snotty lines like, "Don't say disinterested," when what you mean is uninterested. Andrews meant well. He was without malice, but Perry could have boiled him in oil. Yet he never admitted it. Never let anyone there guess why, after one of these humiliating incidents, he sat and sulked and ignored the meals that were delivered to him 3 times a day. At the beginning of June, he stopped eating altogether. He told Dick, "You can wait around for the rope, but not me." And from that moment, he refused to touch food or water, or say one word to anybody. The fast lasted 5 days before the warden took it seriously. On the 6th day, he ordered Smith transferred to the prison hospital, but the move did not lessen Perry's resolve. When attempts were made to force feed him, he fought back, tossed his head, and clenched his jaws until they were rigid as horseshoes. Eventually, he had to be pinioned and fed intravenously or through a tube inserted in a nostril. Even so, over the next 9 weeks, his weight fell from 168 to 115 pounds, and the warden was warned that forced feeding alone could not keep the patient alive indefinitely. Dick, though impressed by Perry's willpower, would not concede that his purpose was suicide. Even when Perry was reported to be in a coma, he told Andrews, with whom he had become friendly, that his former confederate was faking. "He just wants them to think he's crazy." Andrews, a compulsive eater, he had filled a scrapbook with illustrated edibles, everything from strawberry shortcake to roasted pig, said, "Maybe he is crazy, starving himself like that. He just wants to get out of here. Play acting. So they'll say he's crazy and put him in the crazy house." Dick afterward grew fond of quoting Andrews' reply, for it seemed to him a fine specimen of the boy's funny thinking, his off-on-a-cloud complacency. "Well," Andrews allegedly said, "it sure strikes me a hard way to do it. Starving yourself. Because sooner or later we'll all get out of here. Either walk out, or be carried out in a coffin. Myself, I don't care whether I walk or get carried. It's all the same in the end." Dick said, "The trouble with you, Andy, you've got no respect for human life, including your own." Andrews agreed. "And," he said, "I'll tell you something else. If ever I do get out of here alive, I mean over the walls and clear out, well, maybe nobody will know where Andy went, but they'll sure hell know where Andy's been." All summer, Perry undulated between half-awake stupors and sickly, sweat-drenched sleep. Voices roared through his head. One voice persistently asked him, "Where is Jesus? Where?" And once he woke up shouting, "The bird is Jesus! The bird is Jesus!" His favorite old theatrical fantasy, the one in which he thought of himself as Perry O'Parsons, the one-man symphony, returned in the guise of a recurrent dream. The dream's geographical center was a Las Vegas nightclub where, Wearing a white top hat and a white tuxedo, he strutted about a spotlighted stage, playing in turn a harmonica, a guitar, a banjo, drums, sang "You Are My Sunshine," and tap-danced up a short flight of gold-painted prop steps. At the top, standing on a platform, he took a bow. There was no applause. None. And yet, thousands of patrons packed the vast and gaudy room. A strange audience, mostly men and mostly Negroes. Staring at them, the perspiring entertainer at last understood their silence, for suddenly he knew that these were phantoms, the ghosts of the legally annihilated, the hanged, the gassed, the electrocuted. And in the same instant he realized that he was there to join them, that the gold-painted steps had led to a scaffold, that the platform on which he stood was opening beneath him. His top hat tumbled. Urinating, defecating, Perry O'Parsons entered eternity. One afternoon he escaped from a dream and wakened to find the warden standing beside his bed. The warden said, "Sounds like you were having a little nightmare." But Perry wouldn't answer him, and the warden, who on several occasions had visited the hospital and tried to persuade the prisoner to cease his fast, said, "I have something here. From your father. I thought you might want to see it." Perry, his eyes glitteringly immense in a face now almost phosphorescently pale, studied the ceiling. And presently, after placing a picture postcard on the patient's bedside table, the rebuffed visitor departed. That night, Perry looked at the card. It was addressed to the warden and postmarked Blue Lake, California. The message, written in a familiar stubby script, said, "Dear Sir, I understand you have my boy Perry back in custody. Write me, please, what did he do wrong, and if I come there, could I see him? All's well with me, and trust the same with you. Tex J. Smith." Perry destroyed the card, but his mind preserved it, for the few crude words had resurrected him emotionally, revived love and hate, and reminded him that he was still what he had tried not to be. Alive. "And I just decided," he later informed a friend, "that I ought to stay that way. Anybody who wanted my life wasn't going to get any more help from me. They'd have to fight for it." The next morning he asked for a glass of milk, the first sustenance he had volunteered to accept in 14 weeks. Gradually, on a diet of eggnogs and orange juice, he regained weight. By October, the prison physician, Dr. Robert Moore, considered him strong enough to be returned to the row. When he arrived there, Dick laughed and said, "Welcome home, honey." 2 years passed. The departures of Wilson and Spencer left Smith and Hickok and Andrews alone with the row's burning lights and veiled windows. The privileges granted ordinary prisoners were denied them. No radios or card games, not even an exercise period. Indeed, they were never allowed out of their cells, except each Saturday when they were taken to a shower room, then given a once-weekly change of clothing. The only other occasions for momentary release were the far-between visits of lawyers or relatives. Mrs. Hickok came once a month. Her husband had died, she had lost the farm, and, as she told Dick, lived now with one relative, now another. It seemed to Perry as though he existed deep underwater, perhaps because the row usually was as gray and quiet as ocean depths, soundless except for snores, coughs, the whisper of slippered feet, the feathery racket of the pigeons nesting in the prison walls. But not always. "Sometimes," Dick wrote in a letter to his mother, "you can't hear yourself think. They throw men in the cells downstairs, what they call the hole, and plenty of them are fighting mad and crazy to boot. Curse and scream the whole time. It's intolerable, so everybody starts yelling, 'Shut up!' I wish you'd send me earplugs. Only they wouldn't allow me to have them. No rest for the wicked, I guess." The little building had been standing for more than a century, and seasonal changes provoked different symptoms of its antiquity. winter cold saturated the stone and iron fixtures, and in summer, when temperatures often hurtled over the 100 mark, the old cells were malodorous cauldrons. "So hot my skin stings," Dick wrote in a letter dated July 5, 1961. "I try not to move much. I just sit on the floor. My bed's too sweaty to lie down, and the smell makes me sick because of only the one bath a week and always wearing the same clothes. No ventilation whatever, and the light bulbs make everything hotter. Bugs keep bumping on the walls." Unlike conventional prisoners, the condemned are not subjected to a work routine. They can do with their time what they like. Sleep all day, as Perry frequently did. "I pretend I'm a tiny little baby that can't keep its eyes open." Or, as was Andrew's habit, read all night. Andrew's averaged 15 to 20 books a week. His taste encompassed both trash and belles lettres, and he liked poetry, Robert Frost's particularly, but he also admired Whitman, Emily Dickinson, and the comic poems of Ogden Nash. Though the quenchless quality of his literary thirst had soon depleted the shelves of the prison library, the prison chaplain and others sympathetic to Andrews kept him supplied with parcels from the Kansas City Public Library. Dick was rather a bookworm, too. But his interest was restricted to two themes: sex, as represented in the novels of Harold Robbins and Irving Wallace. Perry, after being lent one of these by Dick, returned it with an indignant note: "Degenerate filth for filthy degenerate minds." And law literature. He consumed hours each day leafing through law books, compiling research that he hoped would help reverse his conviction. Also, in pursuit of the same cause, he fired off a cannonade of letters to such organizations as the American Civil Liberties Union and the Kansas State Bar Association, letters attacking his trial as a travesty of due process and urging the recipients to aid him in his quest for a new trial. Perry was persuaded to draft similar pleas, but when Dick suggested that Andy follow their example by writing protests in his own behalf, Andrews replied, "I'll worry about my neck, and you worry about yours." Actually, Dick's neck was not the part of his anatomy that most immediately troubled him. "My hair is coming out by the handfuls," he confided in yet another letter to his mother. "I'm frantic. Nobody in our family was bald-headed as I can recall, and it makes me frantic the idea of being an ugly old bald-head." The Rose two night guards, arriving at work on an autumn evening in 1961, had a piece of news. "Well," one of them announced, "seems like you boys can expect company." The import of the remark was clear to his audience. It meant that two young soldiers, who had been standing trial for the murder of a Kansas railroad worker, had received the ultimate sentence. "Yes, sir," the guard said, confirming this. "They got the death penalty." Dick said, "Sure. It's very popular in Kansas. Juries handed out like they were giving candy to kids." One of the soldiers, George Ronald York, was 18. His companion, James Douglas Latham, was a year older. They were both exceptionally personable, which perhaps explains why hordes of teenaged girls had attended their trial. Though convicted of a single slaying, the pair had claimed seven victims in the course of a cross-country murder spree. Ronnie York, blonde and blue-eyed, had been born and raised in Florida, where his father was a well-known, well-paid deep-sea diver. The Yorks had a pleasantly comfortable home life, and Ronnie, overloved and overpraised by his parents and a worshipful younger sister, was the adored center of it. Latham's background was at the opposite extreme, being every bit as bleak as Perry Smith's. Born in Texas, he was the youngest child of fertile, moneyless, embattled parents who, when finally they separated, left their progeny to fend for themselves, to scatter hither and thither, loose and unwanted as bundles of panhandle tumbleweed. At 17, in need of a refuge, Latham enlisted in the Army. 2 years later, found guilty of an AWOL offense, he was imprisoned in the stockade at Fort Hood, Texas. It was there that he met Ronnie York, who was also under sentence for having gone AWOL. Though they were very unlike, even physically, York being tall and phlegmatic, whereas the Texan was a short, young man with foxy brown eyes animating a compact, cute little face, they found they shared at least one firm opinion. The world was hateful, and everybody in it would be better off dead. "It's a rotten world," Latham said. "There's no answer to it but meanness. That's all anybody understands. Meanness. Burn down the man's barn. He'll understand that. Poison his dog. Kill him." Ronnie said Latham was 100% correct, adding, "Anyway, anybody you kill, you're doing them a favor." The first person they chose to sow favor were two Georgia women, respectable housewives who had the misfortune to encounter York and Latham not long after the murderous pair escaped from the Fort Hood stockade, stole a pickup truck, and drove to Jacksonville, Florida, York's hometown. The scene of the encounter was an Esso station on the dark outskirts of Jacksonville. The date was the night of May 29th, 1961. Originally, the absconding soldiers had traveled to the Florida city with the intention of visiting York's family. Once there, however, York decided it might be unwise to contact his parents. His father sometimes had quite a temper. He and Latham talked it over, and New Orleans was their new destination when they stopped at the Esso station to buy gas. Alongside them, another car was imbibing fuel. It contained the two matronly victims-to-be, who after a day of shopping and pleasure in Jacksonville were returning to their homes in a small town near the Florida-Georgia border. Alas, they had lost their way. York, from whom they asked directions, was most obliging. "You just follow us. We'll put you on the right road." But the road to which he led them was very wrong indeed. A narrow side turning that petered off into swamp. Nevertheless, the ladies followed along faithfully until the lead vehicle halted, and they saw, in the shine of their headlights, the helpful young men approaching them on foot, and saw, but too late, that each was armed with a black bullwhip. The whips were the property of the stolen truck's rightful custodian, a cattleman. It had been Latham's notion to use them as garrotes, which after robbing the women is what they did. In New Orleans, the boys bought a pistol and carved two notches in the handle. During the next 10 days, notches were added in Tullahoma, Tennessee, where they acquired a snappy red Dodge convertible by shooting the owner, a traveling salesman, and in an Illinois suburb of St. Louis, where two more men were slain. The Kansas victim, who followed the preceding five, was a grandfather. His name was Otto Ziegler. He was 62, a robust, friendly fellow, the sort not likely to pass distressed motorists without offering assistance. While spinning along a Kansas highway one fine June morning, Mr. Ziegler spied a red convertible parked by the roadside, its hood up, and a couple of nice-looking youngsters fiddling with the motor. How was the good-hearted Mr. Ziegler to know that nothing ailed the machine? That this was a ruse devised to rob and kill would-be Samaritans? His last words were, "Anything I can do?" York, at a distance of 20 feet, sent a bullet crashing through the old man's skull, then turned to Latham and said, "Pretty good shooting, huh?" Their final victim was the most pathetic. It was a girl, only 18. She was employed as a maid in a Colorado motel where the rampaging pair spent a night, during which she let them make love to her. Then they told her they were on their way to California and invited her to come along. "Come on," Latham urged her. "Maybe we'll all end up movie stars." The girl and her hastily packed cardboard suitcase ended up as blood-soaked wreckage at the bottom of a ravine near Craig, Colorado. But not many hours after she had been shot and thrown there, her assassins were in fact performing before motion picture cameras. Descriptions of the red car's occupants, provided by witnesses who had noticed them loitering in the area where Otto Ziegler's body was discovered, had been circulated through the Midwest and Western states. Roadblocks were erected, and helicopters patrolled the highways. It was a roadblock in Utah that caught York and Latham. Later, at police headquarters in Salt Lake City, a local television company was allowed to film an interview with them. The result, if viewed without sound, would seem to concern two cheerful, milk-fed athletes discussing hockey or baseball. Anything but murder and the roles boastfully confessed they had played in the deaths of 7 people. "Why?" the interviewer asks. "Why did you do it?" And York, with a self-congratulatory grin, answers, "We hate the world." All 5 of the states that vied for the right to prosecute York and Latham endorse judicial homicide. Florida, electrocution. Tennessee, electrocution. Illinois, electrocution. Kansas, hanging. And Colorado, lethal gas. But because it had the firmest evidence, Kansas was victorious. The men on the row first met their new companions November 2, 1961. A guard, escorting the arrivals to their cells, introduced them. "Mr. York, Mr. Latham, I'd like you to know Mr. Smith here, and Mr. Hickok, and Mr. Lowell Lee Andrews, the nicest boy in Walcott." When the parade had passed, Hickok heard Andrews chuckling and said, "What's so funny about that son of a bitch?" "Nothing," Andrews said. "But I was thinking. When you count my 3 and your 4 and their 7, that makes 14 of them and 5 of us. Now 5 into 14 averages out 4 into 14, Hickok curtly corrected him. "There are 4 killers up here and 1 railroaded man. I'm no goddamn killer. I never touched a hair on a human head." Hickok continued writing letters protesting his conviction, and one of these at last bore fruit. The recipient, Everett Stearman, chairman of the Legal Aid Committee of the Kansas State Bar Association, was disturbed by the allegations of the sender, who insisted that he and his co-defendant had not had a fair trial. According to Hickok, the hostile atmosphere in Garden City had made it impossible to impanel an unbiased jury, and therefore a change of venue should have been granted. As for the jurors that were chosen, at least 2 had clearly indicated a presumption of guilt during the voir dire examination. When asked to state his opinion of capital punishment, one man said that ordinarily he was against it, but in this case, no. Unfortunately, the voir dire had not been recorded because Kansas law does not require it unless a specific demand is made. Many of the jurors, moreover, were well acquainted with the deceased. So was the judge. Judge Tate was an intimate friend of Mr. Clutter. But the bulkiest of Hickok's mud pies was aimed at the 2 defense attorneys, Arthur Fleming and Harrison Smith, whose incompetence and inadequacy were the chief cause of the correspondent's present predicament, for no real defense had been prepared or offered by them, and this lack of effort, it was implied, had been deliberate, an act of collusion between the defense and the prosecution. These were grave assertions, reflecting upon the integrity of 2 respected lawyers and a distinguished district judge. But if even partially true, then the constitutional rights of the defendants had been abused. Prompted by Mr. Stearman, the Bar Association undertook a course of action without precedent in Kansas legal history. It appointed a young Wichita attorney, Russell Schultz, to investigate the charges and, should evidence warrant it, challenge the validity of the conviction by bringing habeas corpus proceedings in the Kansas Supreme Court, which had recently upheld the verdict. It would appear that Schultz's investigation was rather one-sided, since it consisted of little more than an interview with Smith and Hickok, from which the lawyer emerged with crusading phrases for the press. The question is this: do poor, plainly guilty defendants have a right to a complete defense? I do not believe that the state of Kansas would be either greatly or for long harmed by the death of these appellants. But I do not believe it could ever recover from the death of due process. Schultz filed his habeas corpus petition, and the Kansas Supreme Court commissioned one of its own retired justices, the Honorable Walter G. Thiel, to conduct a full-scale hearing. And so it came to pass that almost 2 years after the trial, the whole cast reassembled in the courtroom at Garden City. The only important participants absent were the original defendants. In their stead, as it were, stood Judge Tate, old Mr. Fleming, and Harrison Smith, whose careers were imperiled. not because of the appellant's allegations per se, but because of the apparent credit the Bar Association bestowed upon them. The hearing, which at one point was transferred to Lansing, where Judge Thiel heard Smith and Hickok testify, took 6 days to complete. Ultimately, every point was covered. 8 jurors swore they had never known any member of the slain family. 4 admitted some slight acquaintance with Mr. Clutter, but each, including N.L. Dunnan, the airport operator who had made the controversial reply during the voir dire, testified that he had entered the jury box with an unprejudiced mind. Schultz challenged Dunnan. "Do you feel, sir, that you would have been willing to go to trial with a juror whose state of mind was the same as yours?" Dunnan said yes, he would. And Schultz then said, "Do you recall being asked whether or not you were averse to capital punishment?" Nodding, the witness answered, "I told them under normal conditions I would probably be averse to it. But with the magnitude of this crime, I could probably vote in favor." Tangling with Tate was more difficult. Schultz soon realized he had a tiger by the tail. Responding to questions relevant to his supposed intimacy with Mr. Clutter, the judge said, "He, Clutter, was once a litigant in this court, a case over which I presided, a damage action involving an airplane falling on his property. He was suing for damages to, I believe, some fruit trees. Other than that, I had no occasion to associate with him. None whatever. I saw him perhaps once or twice in the course of a year." Schultz, floundering, switched the subject. "Do you know," he asked, "what the attitude of the people was in this community after the apprehension of these two men?" "I believe I do," the judge told him with scathing confidence. "It is my opinion that the attitude toward them was that of anyone else charged with a criminal offense, that they should be tried as the law provides, that if they were guilty, they should be convicted, that they should be given the same fair treatment as any other person. There was no prejudice against them because they were accused of crime." "You mean," Schultz slyly said, "you saw no reason for the court on its own motion to grant a change of venue?" Tate's lips curved downward. His eyes blazed. "Mr. Schultz," he said, as though the name was a prolonged hiss, "the court cannot on its own grant a change of venue. That would be contrary to Kansas law. I couldn't grant a change unless it was properly requested." But why had such a request not been made by the defendant's attorneys? Schultz now pursued this question with the attorneys themselves, for to discredit them and prove that they had not supplied their clients with the minimum protection was, from the Wichita lawyer's viewpoint, the hearing's principal objective. Fleming and Smith withstood the onslaught in good style, particularly Fleming, who, wearing a bold red tie and an abiding smile, endured Schultz with gentlemanly resignation. Explaining why he had not applied for a change of venue, he said, "I felt that since the Reverend Cohen, the minister of the Methodist Church, and a man of substance here, a man of high standing, as well as many other ministers here, had expressed themselves against capital punishment, that at least the leaven had been cast in the area, and there were likely more people here inclined to be lenient in the matter of the penalty than perhaps in other parts of the state. Then I believe it was a brother of Mrs. Clutter's who made a statement that appeared in the press indicating he did not feel the defendants should be put to death." Schultz had a score of charges, but underlying them all was the implication that because of community pressure, Fleming and Smith had deliberately neglected their duties. Both men, Schultz maintained, had betrayed their clients by not consulting with them sufficiently. Mr. Fleming replied, "I worked on the case to the very best of my ability, giving it more time than I do most cases," by waiving a preliminary hearing. Smith answered, "But sir, neither Mr. Fleming nor I had been appointed counsel at the time of the waiver," by making remarks to newsmen damaging to the defendants. Schultz to Smith, "Are you aware that a reporter, Ron Cull of the Topeka Daily Capital quoted you on the second day of the trial as saying there was no doubt of Mr. Hickok's guilt, but that you were concerned only with obtaining life imprisonment rather than the death penalty? Smith to Schultz. No, sir. If I was quoted as saying that, it was incorrect. And by failing to prepare a proper defense. This last proposition was the one Schultz peddled hardest. It is relevant, therefore, to reproduce an opinion of it written by three federal judges as the result of a subsequent appeal to the United States Court of Appeals, 10th Circuit. We think, however, that those viewing the situation in retrospect have lost sight of the problems which confronted attorneys Smith and Fleming when they undertook the defense of these petitioners. When they accepted the appointments, each petitioner had made a full confession, and they did not then contend, nor did they seriously contend at any time in the state courts, that these confessions were not voluntary. A radio taken from the Clutter home and sold by the petitioners in Mexico City had been recovered, and the attorneys knew of other evidence of their guilt then in the possession of the prosecution. When called upon to plead to the charges against them, they stood mute, and it was necessary for the court to enter a plea of not guilty for them. There was no substantial evidence then, and none has been produced since the trial, to substantiate a defense of insanity. The attempt to establish insanity as a defense because of serious injuries in accidents years before, and headaches and occasional fainting spells of Hickok, was like grasping at the proverbial straw. The attorneys were faced with a situation where outrageous crimes committed on innocent persons had been admitted. Under these circumstances, they would have been justified in advising that petitioners enter pleas of guilty and throw themselves on the mercy of the court. Their only hope was through some turn of fate, the lives of these misguided individuals might be spared. In the report he submitted to the Kansas Supreme Court, Judge Thiel found that the petitioners had received a constitutionally fair trial. The court thereupon denied the writ to abolish the verdict and set a new date of execution, October 25, 1962. As it happened, Lowell Lee Andrews, whose case had twice traveled all the way to the United States Supreme Court, was scheduled to hang 1 month later. The Clutter Slayers, granted a reprieve by a federal judge, evaded their date. Andrews kept his. In the disposition of capital cases in the United States, the median elapsed time between sentence and execution is approximately 17 months. Recently, in Texas, an armed robber was electrocuted 1 month after his conviction. But in Louisiana, at the present writing, two rapists have been waiting for a record 12 years. The variance depends a little on luck and a great deal on the extent of litigation. The majority of the lawyers handling these cases are court-appointed and work without recompense. But more often than not, the courts, in order to avoid future appeals based on complaints of inadequate representation, appoint men of first quality who defend with commendable vigor. However, even an attorney of moderate talent can postpone doomsday year after year, for the system of appeals that pervades American jurisprudence amounts to a legalistic wheel of fortune, a game of chance, somewhat fixed in the favor of the criminal, that the participants play interminably, first in the state courts, then through the federal courts until the ultimate tribunal is reached, the United States Supreme Court. But even defeat there does not signify if petitioner's counsel can discover or invent new grounds for appeal. Usually they can, and so once more the wheel turns, and turns until, perhaps some years later, the prisoner arrives back at the nation's highest court, probably only to begin again the slow, cruel contest. But at intervals, the wheel does pause to declare a winner, or, though with increasing rarity, a loser. Andrews' lawyers fought to the final moment, but their client went to the gallows on Friday, November 30th, 1962. That was a cold night, Hickok said, talking to a journalist with whom he corresponded and who was periodically allowed to visit him. cold and wet. It had been raining like a bastard, and the baseball field was mud up to your cojones. So when they took Andy out to the warehouse, they had to walk him along the path. We were all at our windows watching. Perry and me, Ronnie York, Jimmy Latham. It was just after midnight, and the warehouse was lit up like a Halloween pumpkin. The doors wide open. We could see the witnesses, a lot of guards, the doctor and the warden. Every damn thing but the gallows. It was off at an angle, but we could see its shadow. A shadow on the wall, like the shadow of a boxing ring. The chaplain and four guards had charge of Andy, and when they got to the door, they stopped a second. Andy was looking at the gallows. You could sense he was. His arms were tied in front of him. All of a sudden, the chaplain reached out and took off Andy's glasses. Which was kind of pitiful. Andy without his glasses. They led him on inside, and I wondered he could see to climb the steps. It was real quiet. Just nothing but this dog barking way off. Some town dog. Then we heard it. The sound. And Jimmy Latham said, "What was that?" And I told him what it was. The trap door. Then it was real quiet again. Except that dog. Old Andy. He danced a long time. They must have had a real mess to clean up. Every few minutes, the doctor came to the door and stepped outside and stood there with this stethoscope in his hand. I wouldn't say he was enjoying his work. Kept gasping, like he was gasping for breath, and he was crying, too. Jimmy said, "Get a load of that, Nance." I guess the reason he stepped outside was so the others wouldn't see he was crying. Then he'd go back and listen to hear if Andy's heart had stopped. Seemed like it never would. The fact is, his heart kept beating for 19 minutes. Andy was a funny kid, Hickok said, smiling lopsidedly as he propped a cigarette between his lips. It was like I told him. He had no respect for human life, not even his own. Right before they hanged him, he sat down and ate 2 fried chickens. And that last afternoon, he was smoking cigars and drinking Coke and writing poetry. When they came to get him and we said our goodbye, I said, "I'll be seeing you soon, Andy. 'Cause I'm sure we're going to the same place. So scout around and see if you can't find a cool, shady spot for us down there." He laughed and said he didn't believe in heaven or hell, just dust unto dust. And he said an aunt and uncle had been to see him and told him they had a coffin waiting to carry him to some little cemetery in North Missouri, the same place where the 3 he disposed of were buried. They planned to put Andy right alongside them. He said when they told him that, he could hardly keep a straight face. I said, "Well, you're lucky to have a grave. Most likely they'll give Perry and me to the vivisectionist." We joked on like that till it was time to go. And just as he was going, he handed me a piece of paper with a poem on it. I don't know if he wrote it or copied it out of a book. My impression was he wrote it. If you're interested, I'll send it to you. He later did so, and Andrew's farewell message turned out to be the 9th stanza of Gray's Elegy Written in a Country Churchyard. The boasts of heraldry, the pomp of power, and all that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave, await alike the inevitable hour. The paths of glory lead but to the grave. I really liked Andy. He was a nut. Not a real nut, like they kept hollering. But, you know, just goofy. He was always talking about breaking out of here and making his living as a hired gun. He liked to imagine himself roaming around Chicago or Los Angeles with a machine gun inside a violin case. Cooling guys. Said he'd charge $1,000 per stiff. Hickok laughed, presumably at the absurdity of his friend's ambitions, sighed, and shook his head. But for someone his age, he was the smartest person I ever come across. A human library. When that boy read a book, it stayed read. Of course, he didn't know a dumb darn thing about life. Me, I'm an ignoramus except when it comes to what I know about life. I've walked along a lot of mean streets. I've seen a white man flogged. I've watched babies born. I've seen a girl, and her no more than 14